the organizers for putting this conference together. Let me try to explain what I'm going to talk about. So what I mean by the Kolmogorov theorem is sort of his, I guess, 1954, I think it was, formulation of the KAM theorem. So you perturb a Hamiltonian, and you want to show that the classical orbits are not far from the unperturbed orbits. So the whole talk will be devoted to the idea of perturbing a harmonic oscillator and looking at its energies. And before I go on, let me mention that this is based on joint work with Sandro Graffi and also with some key contributions from Dario Bambusi. Okay, so we start with a harmonic oscillator, and I need to include the dependence. I won't always write this, but I need to set some frequencies and actually include the dependence on the frequencies. I'll explain that a little later. So we get the usual thing, and then we have frequencies omega appearing in the quadratic part. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I really do mean the usual thing. Wait, say that again? Oh, positive. Seems to me that when you have Laplacian plus potential, it seems to me that whatever appears here is meant to be positive. And anyway, I do mean positive Laplacian in contrast to the... I can't keep switching back and forth, and I usually do a geometric situation where the positive is the common one, so I apologize if this seems unusual. Okay, of course, a very, your first course in quantum mechanics, you compute this. The energy levels as a function of h-bar are the familiar things. The frequencies enter here, and I'm going to use a shorthand notation, I hope, since this is such an old problem that this won't confuse anybody. Alpha here is a multi-index. I'm on Rn. N is the dimension. Of course, it could be zero. And when I say alpha plus a half, I mean add a half, shift each entry by a half, and pair it with the frequencies. Of course, everyone knows that's the right answer. And then the idea is to perturb. So P0 will go to some perturbed Hamiltonian. And I want, for the moment, let me just say something completely general. I'll take the original one, and I'll add epsilon times some other operator. Unless I want squares over two here. Okay, so the idea, the general idea, is to study the spectrum of this. Of course, I want to restrict myself to operators Q for which this, is still a nicely defined operator with a discrete spectrum. And the idea is, basically that the perturbed levels, you should somehow be able to relate those up to some error term to the unperturbed levels. So the classical KAM theorem says the orbits are close to the unperturbed orbits. The perturbed orbits are close to the unperturbed orbits. No longer periodic, but close in a physical sense. And here we're trying to study the energy levels and say that they're close to the original simple harmonic oscillator problem. All right, so that's the idea. What I think of as a fairly traditional semi-classical result would be to study energies of order h-bar, and in which case this approximates that up to order h-bar squared. I don't have a source even for that. I just think of that as sort of old semi-classical, sort of classical semi-classical approximation, if you will. You study energies on the order of h-bar, and E, the difference between the unperturbed levels and the perturbed levels, be found to be order h-bar squared. So much of what's been done recently concerns trying to go further. This is large chalk. Trying to extend this to energies that are some wider swath. And so I'll mention some of the other recent results, but before I do that, just to compare, have this up for comparison, let me go ahead and state a theorem. So the assumptions, I haven't said anything about Q yet. You know, of course, you'd like to do this for a wide class of perturbations. Perhaps just perturbing the potential. Perhaps Q would be just thought of as perturbing the potential. That's probably the most useful example. Let me outline the assumptions that I'm going to make. I don't want to get too much into the technicalities right away before I state the theorem. So let me just say that Q is required to be in a space of vial pseudo-differential operators with analytic symbols and the vial symbol will have to go to zero at infinity. That's one restriction. And you know what the restriction we're putting on is actually quite strong. It's also quite technical, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. So instead of introducing it at this stage, let me just give you an example to think about while I state the theorem. What we can do is essentially do a polynomial in x and c, and then cut it off in some analytic way. So that would be an example of the kind of perturbation we could do. Analytic way. So, you know, exactly how you cut it off is not that important, but I guess you know, we're thinking of this as essentially being all our proof is concentrated near x, c equals zero. So, essentially, the important part of the perturbation is the piece out front. And the other restriction that I need to make even before stating the theorem is on the frequencies. I said I had to, instead of just letting that be equal to all be equal to 1, which is a standard normalization, I have a Diophantine condition on the frequencies. And I will go through enough of the strategy, the proof, to show you where this occurs, but if you know the ordinary KAM theorem, this is the Diophantine condition from the usual, from the classical theorem. So what it says is, if remember, omega is a set of frequencies, there are n of them, so I'll, just for convenience, restrict them to be between 0 and 1, and I have to put a condition on it that it's a member of an element of a set defined by certain conditions. I need omega dot k, to be larger than or on the order of some negative power of k. So not small. And this is for, there exists a tau greater than zero such that this is true for all k in z n minus, of course, the origin. Okay, so let me just ponder that for a second. If the frequencies were rationally dependent, if you could write a linear combination of the frequencies omega with rational coefficients and get zero, then this would be zero at some point. You know, you could find some integers k for which this is zero, and you need that. You need to avoid that situation because this expression is going to appear in the denominator in your perturbation theory. So. All eigenvalues are non-degenerate because the frequencies are rationally independent. So, in particular, frequencies rationally independent. And the idea behind this work is to really follow the classical KAM theorem as closely as we can, and this is the restriction from the classical case. With that, I can try to state the actual theorem. And this is, I guess the paper is going to come out with Sandro and I. So it says that given some parameter eta, then there exists some limiting values, h bar star and epsilon star, and a set omega epsilon inside omega 0 defined for each epsilon below this limit. So these can be the limits on the parameter h bar and the limits on the parameter epsilon. Eta will have to do with how big a level I can apply this to. Let me state this question, such that for h bar within this range and epsilon within the range of given by epsilon star, an original frequency in this set that depends on epsilon, again, this is a complication that occurs in the classical theorem, that the unperturbed frequencies live in a set determined by the perturbation parameter. If you haven't seen that before, it's disturbing, I think, but it's there in the classical case for good reason. Those are all my restrictions, I think. The spectrum of the perturbed operator is given by for alpha h bar less than eta by a quantization formula. There's some overall shift, epsilon of h bar, E of epsilon h bar, and then some change in the frequencies, h bar omega of h bar epsilon dotted into alpha plus a half, and then some remainder. And then I need a whole other board to explain. These things are. So this is sort of an overall shift. It doesn't depend on the quantum number, it's just an overall shift in the spectrum. And what we can say about it is epsilon is continuous in H bar and analytic in the parameter. And of course, if you shut off the perturbation, you have no rescaling. So as epsilon goes to zero, it goes to zero. The frequencies are sort of similar. The same behavior, continuous in H bar, analytic in epsilon. And if you shut off the frequencies go revert to their original values if you shut off the perturbation. And then the error estimate, the remainder term, is uniformly bounded by the alpha h bar squared. C is independent. I'm sorry, I changed the notation in the middle here. Let me stick with that. Yeah, it's not the best notation, but I didn't want to include an extra zero because I'm already... Yeah, I mean that the... Exactly. Basically, the spectrum from... The intersection of the spectrum... But the perturbation is going to zero, but the you
your potential is going to zero.
The potential is always quadratic.
Ah, I mean,
No, I guess I think of I guess that's right. R is zero when alpha is equal to zero. So this perturbation applies to the ground state, and R is only a higher order effect. So as alpha h bar goes to zero, E does not change, but R does. But the way I've defined it, some E could be higher order terms in E could be incorporated into R. The way I've said it here. So I always needed it to be in omega zero, but then I need to restrict even further depending on epsilon.
Yes,
and I guess. I have one more. I did mean to put that up there. I just got distracted. So these are sort of Diophantine restrictions, and as omega goes to zero, they revert to this basic one. And this set is known to have measure. I guess this is sort of analytic number theory here. This set is known to have measure.
Fix your diophantine solution. The
That's right. Tau is not fixed. This is.
But
sorry.
If you fix tau and the constant before, then omega epsilon will also become an epsilon. In usual case, you fix the diophantine information and for epsilon solve.
You can do it independently of epsilon. I believe that should work just as usual, but.
When it is continuous in H, can you say something like square root of H?
good question. I don't know offhand. Yeah, I believe. I believe that should be the case, but I. I believe it should have an asymptotic expansion, but I would have to recheck the details. I apologize. I'll have to think more about that. That is seeming too vague the way it's put there. So that's essentially the result. Our idea in doing this was to try to follow the classical proof as much as possible. Try to be simple-minded and just sort of quantize the classical proof. Let me mention other results which are in some sense better than what we're doing here, certainly in terms of the order, in terms of the bound on the error. So recent work sort of extending this old classical limit. There was a paper in 1992 by Justrand. So he's looked at non-degenerate potential wells, the Schrodinger operator with a non-degenerate potential well. And you think of the quadratic term in the potential well as being the harmonic oscillator, and all higher order terms as being a perturbation of that. And he proved a quantization formula for semi-excited states. So that means energies on the order of some fractional power of h bar. And the error is rapidly decreasing in h bar. Right. And a much broader class of perturbations, much not nearly so restrictive as what I should have under assumption one there. And then there was a paper of Van Bussy, Graffi, and Paul. Which basically the point of which was to sort of extend Justrand's work, and what they did is a slight improvement over this. You get log h bar to some negative fractional power for the energies, and the error term is exponential now. A to the minus 1 or h bar to some power. So the error terms I want to point out over here, this is our error bound H squared. So what we're doing in many ways is much poorer. These are very sharp error bounds. And then finally, directly related to quantizing the KAM theorem, Popov's work from 2000, which covers energies in a range of the sort that I've considered, and it has very good exponential error bounds. this is essentially applying quantum Birkhoff normal forms to the K, to the invariant tori of the KAM theorem. So I guess the contrast. Oh, before this season? 782. Oh, I apologize. So the I guess the contrast between our result and Popov, his results are much better, but and what we're doing is distinguished by its direct its simple-mindedness. We're just trying to do a canonical quantization of the classical flow. So let me try to outline, if I can, the strategy. Well, let's see. Before I do that, let me give actually. I do want to give a precise statement under one of what this restriction is. So the restriction on Q. So Q will be the Weyl quantization of some symbol, the semi-classical Weyl quantization of some symbol little q, and we'll start out with little q integrable, and then we can define angular coefficients according to the flow of the original Hamiltonian of P0, the original harmonic oscillator flow. So this, we can think of this as action. This R2n decomposes into invariant tori of the original flow. We can think of action angle variables as parameterizing those. So the actions would be given by this expression, if I get it right, cj squared plus omega j. Perhaps a 2 that I should include there, standard. And then angles. So the classical flow of the Hamiltonian of P0 leaves the actions invariant and just changes the angles linearly. So the Fourier coefficient is going to be given by integrating over the flow. So I'm going to define Q tilde K just by integrating over the angle variables, which live in a torus, Q composed with the classical flow for angle up to angle theta. And then introduce weight e to the minus I k dot phi. So k here is an integer. All right, so this is the flow of the original symbol. And then my space consists of functions which have a very nice behavior So I'm going to introduce two parameters, and the norm that has to be finite is going to be the sum over k in z n of e to the minus k times rho, the integrals over r to n of the spatial Fourier transform. So I take this Fourier coefficient k, this is plus. I take the kth Fourier coefficient according to the averaging over these angle variables, and I take it's itself a function of x comma c, a function of in R to n. I take its spatial Fourier transform, and I integrate that against a weight, an exponential weight. So you can think of this as I'm requiring Fourier coefficients to be rapidly decreasing, but I'm sort of separating out Fourier coefficients on the invariant torus and then spatial Fourier coefficients off the torus and requiring separate rates of decrease on each of those. So it's a fairly technical restriction. It's quite restrictive, I have to say. The requirement is that that norm be finite. And I'll give enough of a strategy to prove to say why we have to do that, why we have to go to such a extreme restriction on our symbols. We're trying to be simple-minded, and we have to pay for it somewhere. We have to, of course, this doesn't all work that simply, and this is essentially where we're paying the price for what we're trying to do. Okay, so the whole point of this result was not so much that we were looking for a particular result, but that we were trying to see if we could implement a particular strategy. So the strategy behind this is, in some sense, the main idea. So we want to conjugate, you have H epsilon is this perturbation, and you want to conjugate this back to a harmonic oscillator. You'd like to do that. By some unitary transformation. So that is, I'd like to find a U such that U, H, U inverse is just a nice harmonic oscillator. of course, we can't do that. It's not true. But we want to at least make this simpler. And the sense of which I mean simpler is that we want the perturbation to go to a higher power of epsilon. And that we can do. So let's take U to be the generator of the unitary transformation. U will be W, so I'll write it like this. E to the epsilon I epsilon W H bar. And then U H epsilon U inverse with that assumption will be just P0 plus a first order term plus all the higher order stuff which I'll lump together. So where an easy calculation, what's P1? Well, sandwich this between those, you get a commutator. And let me just not do this in my head. Let me make sure I get the right answer. So first order is, first of all, Q, and then a commutator.
of W with P0.
Okay, so we'd like P1 to go away. We want to do this once and eliminate the first order term and be left with a second order term, and then we repeat and make the perturbation get smaller and smaller until it goes away. All right, so of course we can't make this zero. First thing. So what can we do with it? Well, if we make it commute with the original harmonic oscillator, then we can absorb some of its terms into a change in the frequencies. So the goal, you'd like to have it be zero. You can't do that. So let's just insist, try to find W such that P1 commutes with P0. Right, so part of it can be incorporated back into it, something that looks like a harmonic oscillator. So we look at the Weyl symbols. Everything up here is meant to be a Weyl pseudo-differential operator. So we can write an equivalent statement in terms of the symbols. Little p1 is q plus the Moyal bracket WP0. These are full Weyl symbols, not principal symbols, but full symbols. Now, the nice thing about this is P0 is quadratic. So the Moyal bracket is just the Poisson bracket. So we have P0. Let me just reproduce this. P1 equals Q plus. So now that's the Poisson bracket. And similarly, for this condition here, we get a Poisson bracket between P0 and P1. So P1 is going to be invariant under the flow of the original harmonic oscillator. And then we want to somehow find W to satisfy that condition at the same time. So the solution, so now we're, this is basically, now we're just doing a classical problem. Now we're just trying to find, instead of trying to find a unitary transformation, we're just trying to find a canonical transformation that reduces the order of the perturbation. So the classical homological equation. Okay, and its solution is not so bad. Okay, so this condition is that P1 would be invariant under the generator of the flow. So what we'll do for P1 is, and did I have those? No, unfortunately, I just erased. the solution, P1 is just going to be Q tilde 0. It's going to be the average, if you remember what I had. It's the definition of these angular coefficients. The zeroth coefficient is just the average over the flow. So I take Q composed with the flow, and I average it. And then the higher order terms of Q are going to have to be canceled by W. So the rest of the solution is that W is equal to sum minus I over, here's where the small denominator appears, W dot K, K in Zn not equal to zero, essentially the higher order pieces. So the, if you, you probably don't remember, the Q tildes, the definition of the Q tildes was this formula with an e to the I k dot phi in it. So higher order Fourier coefficients. Okay, so the Diophantine condition comes in because we're gonna do this over and over again, then we're gonna try to sum the terms. We need to make sure that this denominator is never close to zero. Denominator. And this solution here is essentially what happens in the original Kolmogorov theorem. The same kind of equation as this homological equation. And the same idea for solving it, of breaking it up into Fourier coefficients in the angle variable. All right, so you know, you can see if the frequencies omega were rationally dependent, then even at this very first stage, one of these terms would be infinite and we'd be stuck. So the Diophantine condition makes sure that all these terms, when we keep doing this, are well behaved. Okay, now the trick is to, not only is this the solution, but one can control the norms of P1 and W in this analytic space that I defined in terms of the norm of Q, with perhaps a slight change in the parameters. And that's the technical part, which I mean to not say anything more about in this talk. But conceptually, the idea is just solve this equation. What do you get? You sort of get W, which defines your first iteration of the unitary transformation. P1, which is the first part of the symbol. P1 is a function only of the actions. Right, it does not depend on the angle variables because those have been averaged out. So I can think of P1, if I do a Taylor series, P1 of x, comma, c is going to be some constant, epsilon 1, plus some linear term, plus something of higher order. Something quadratic. So this first linear term, epsilon 1, is going to account for an overall shift. The AJs can be absorbed into change in the frequencies, and what's left is a remainder term that's going to end up being part of this. So if I plug that back in, if I made P1 go away completely, then the frequencies would never change. But this form here tells me that P0 plus epsilon P1 is given by P0 with frequencies omega replaced by omega plus A epsilon plus E1 epsilon function h bar plus the remainder part. And this is a fourth order operator, and it vanishes because we've removed the zero and the linear term in terms of the actions. This is order 2 in terms of the actions. The actions are functions of x squared and c squared, so this vanishes to order 4. A fact which will be important later on. Okay, so the strategy is that we have we now have U H epsilon U inverse is P0 with a new frequency, an overall shift. This is times the identity. A remainder term and then a term of order epsilon squared. Okay, so we try to repeat this. We try to iterate this procedure. So I'll call this first one U1. And then at each iteration, it turns out I can double the power of epsilon here. So I don't want to go through any more of the details than I've sketched already, but if I keep, at each stage I construct a new U to sandwich my perturbed operator against. And what I can do is get some change in the frequencies and some shift times the identity, and I get a similar kind of error term here that's always fourth order and always vanishes to order four at the origin. That never changes. And then this epsilon is actually epsilon to the 2p at this stage. Right, so I do the same thing I did in that step, and I try to solve the terms as best I can. Now, of course, you want to be able to let p go to infinity. To get rid of this entirely, you want to try to let p go to infinity. So that you know, you keep iterating this, and you want it to converge to something. So the trick what is really the difficult part here is make this converge p goes to infinity, right? You have a perturbation theory, which is very nice, but we want to make this actually a well-defined unitary map in the limit as p goes to infinity. That's why you need these heavy-duty analytic norms. You can't just do this without a lot of control over basically the solutions of this homological equation. You need to control these extremely well in terms of the initial data q. And so that's why we have such severe restrictions, because if you don't, this is very difficult to make it converge. So the restrictions we've imposed mean that this convergence, the proof of this convergence, is almost exactly like the classical case. Right? It's essentially the same problem as the classical problem. And everything here is almost identical to the classical problem, except that everything depends on h-bar. And these are the vial quantizations of the classical symbols rather than the symbols themselves. But it's very, very close. So I won't say anything more about this, except let me just say that the estimates that we needed to do this are really taken from this earlier paper. This homological equation, same homological equation, comes up in what they did, and is in some sense the hard technical part of the proof is in this earlier work, not in what we're doing. Okay, so one final remark. So what you're left with when you do this, you get U. How should I describe it? You get U. The full construction leads to a unitary operator with this property. That's epsilon E times I plus epsilon R, where R is fourth order. Vanishes to order four. All right, well, let me just say this. The symbol is O of XC the fourth. So the final part of this construction, everything up to now has followed the classical part. The final sort of semi-classical part of the construction is to get a bound on the error term. And that is not such a difficult thing. I mean, it's not a bounded operator. R is fourth order. But what we are looking at is perturbation of these harmonic oscillator states. So what we really need to put a bound on is the matrix element of R with respect to the harmonic oscillator basis. For the original, the unperturbed oscillator, P0. So we need to bound this matrix element. And what we know is that R is fourth order, so that's not very helpful. And we know that the symbol vanishes to order 4. That is very helpful. If you think in the Bargmann representation, which turns R2n into Cn, this basis, you know, one of the main reasons for using the Bargmann representation is that the harmonic oscillator basis, instead of being Hermite functions, which are a little bit difficult to write down, are very explicit powers. Polynomial powers times the weight, depends on h bar. So if you think this weight is sort of a something that's always there, if you ignore that, essentially the harmonic oscillator basis consists of homogeneous polynomials, so very easy to work with. And the idea behind this bound of this error term is just that if you look where this concentrates, a simple, this is naively for the moment, think of that as a calculus exercise. You're looking at something that's basically R, the radius to the power alpha, e to the minus R squared over h bar. Just try to find the maximum, very simple problem. Concentrates on z equal to, or on the order of square root of alpha h bar. And if I look at R in the Bargmann representation, this fact means that it's going to be represented by an operator that vanishes to order 4 at the origin. So R vanishes to order 4 at the origin. So order 4 will be this raised to the fourth power, which will be alpha h bar squared. So this suggests that it should be true that this matrix element is bounded by some constant times. And in fact, if you switch to the Bargmann representation, the proof of that is not much harder than this. It's easy to make that precise. So that's where the uniform error bound comes from. And I guess my hesitation about what exactly the behavior of F of E is in H bar is that E over there is defined as basically the sum of an analytic series here, and I'm temporarily confused about how to extract a limit as H bar goes to zero from this, but I believe it should be possible to make that precise. Not feeling able to work that out in my head. So I guess I'll stop there. Thank you very much. Yes, I think if we worked harder, we could stop the series at a finite order and maximize and do that and get exponential error bounds. I guess our feeling was that those earlier papers already had exponential error bounds, and what we're adding to that is. Oh, that.